private group satisfaction. When they are up for silver and bronze medals, yep, the South need not necessarily rise again. It never apparently set. And more extreme weather in the Philippines. President Barack Obama sends his condolences to people there. And we have weather, and we have the alternative weather, which many people like. And we'll put that all on the KBOO website. This has been Air Cascadia for Monday, April 28th, 2014. Get the facts, know your rights, take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned. It's Locus Focus coming up right now.
And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Artemis Foods, Portland's local organic and sustainable catering company since 2001. Special events, corporate and wedding catering with seasonal menus and service supported by sustainable business operations. Artemis offers full service and drop-off catering. Information at artemisfoods.com.
The program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or WilkinCPAS.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Precious land is being swiped away from poor farmers in the developing world, and it's not the work of corrupt dictators or Mother Nature. The culprit is the World Bank. This morning we'll hear how this powerful entity is behind the rampant theft of land and resources from some of the world's poorest people. My guest is Anuradha Mittal, Executive Director of the Oakland Institute, who has just released a report called Willful Blindness, How the World Bank's Doing Business Rankings Impoverish Smallholder Farmers. Anuradha, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, a friend of mine's show today to humanitarian work for the World Bank, particularly in connection with tsunami in the Indian Ocean a few years ago. And she wanted to know, how does the World Bank reconcile the humanitarian side? The World Bank shows this schism, I think, really very sharply.
Many of us see end poverty. Given that mission, it is very normal for all of us to expect that related to the dealing with some of the biggest challenges of our times, which is ending poverty, improving food security, dealing with hunger, climate change. So what your friend asked is not at all surprising. But what we are finding, and in fact, in its 70-year history, if you look at the track record of this institution, unfortunately, this development has been a very top-down approach, which prays at the altar of free market and believes that instead of the governments, it is really the market that will deliver to the people their freedom from hunger and poverty. In our case, this campaign that we have launched in collaboration with over 200 groups around the world, and these include smallholder farmers, to trade unions, to environmental groups such as the Friends of the Earth International. The campaign is called Our Land, Our Business, which is a demand to let the World Bank know that it does not have the credibility, it does not have the legitimacy to be determining what should happen to land in third world countries. It has no right to promote land being made a marketable commodity when most of the people in the third world depend on land for their livelihoods. It's their future, it's their culture, it's very sacred to them.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this disconnect between what is really needed in these countries and how the World Bank goes about doing it. And I think of a lot of issues ranging from building mega dams to building mega coal fire plants at the same time that they're talking about, you know, mitigating climate change. But in some ways, the thing that's the most frightening to me is what you talk about in this report is there is a big drive now around the world for certain countries, in particular China and other countries, to buy up as much land in Africa and parts of Southeast Asia to grow food, or either to grow food for their countries or for their multinational corporations to make a killing. And it's really at the expense of these farmers that you're talking about. So let's talk about this disconnect between the World Bank supposedly there to help impoverished nations get back on their feet or whatever, and the fact that the wealth base for these countries, which is their land, is something that the World Bank is encouraging multinational corporations to steal from these farmers.
Sure. Well, you know, given its stated goal, what the World Bank has embarked upon, and in fact has been doing since the closing down of the structural adjustment programs that the listeners might be familiar with.
And let's talk a bit about that. What are the structural adjustment?
Following the closure of the structural adjustment programs, the bank embarked on a new program called Doing Business Rankings. Now, what this really means is that it ranks countries, it scores them according to how Washington officials believe is the ease of doing business there. And what it has really resulted in is developing countries competing with each other. It has resulted in them deregulating their economies in the hopes of attracting foreign investment. But often what the bank considers beneficial for foreign business is the exact opposite for the local communities. So given those doing business rankings, you would find that any kind of minimum wage laws or protection of the environment or protection of agricultural sector would be seen as something that gets you a bad score. So it is through those doing business rankings, there has been emphasis on making your land a marketable commodity. Or if you look at a country like Liberia, which has gone through, I think, in the last 2-3 years, more than 38 reforms, policy reforms it has made, including things such as, if you're setting up shop as a foreign business, say a palm oil plantation, you don't have to do environmental impact assessment. And that has gotten Liberia a positive ranking. But the result of that is that just in this country, over 1.5 million acres of land today are controlled and are under 99-year leases for palm oil plantations owned by the English, Malaysians, Indonesian multinational corporations.
Well, I want to go back and talk a bit about structural adjustment, which you just mentioned, because probably a lot of listeners don't know what that is. And wasn't that one of the more controversial programs that the World Bank was doing for a long time?
Well, definitely. I mean, the World Bank has always, we tend to think of as a bank as one that is giving loan, providing credit to developing countries so they could embark on projects that will deal with the challenges they face. Unfortunately, those loans have come with conditionalities. So previously, they were known as structural adjustment programs. That means they could interfere in terms of how much government supported smallholder farmers, what kind of extension services or rural credit schemes it has, or how much budget was allocated to public health. By imposing those conditionalities, World Bank was able to really strangle this policy space that was taken away from developing countries, which has had horrible consequences for the upliftment of the most poor in these countries. And when it was finally done away with, and that was again a result of international organizing from, you know, community activists in different countries in Africa to Asia to Latin America marching together with colleagues in the West, when they were able to put an end to it, you find it resurface as doing business rankings. And let me tell you that it is not just that they rank these countries and prepare like a report card on them, when, by the way, the citizens of these countries have not asked the World Bank, have not signed up for the World Bank to be their school teacher. It has huge consequences because these rankings determine what kind of loans, what kind of investments, what kind of credit is made available to these countries.
So what gives the World Bank the authority to do this in the first place?
You know, that's an excellent question, and that's exactly what the campaign Our Land, Our Business is asking, that given it is our land, our natural resources, which have been farmed and lived upon for generations, and for millennia by the agropastoralists, by the indigenous peoples, by the fisherfolk, what gave the World Bank the authority to start scoring them and creating this race to the bottom that the governments are forced to join in?
So I'm still curious, like, in the mechanism, is it just that the World Bank has this money that they can give to these countries, or they can encourage foreign investment, and countries are so desperate that they will just dismantle the few environmental regulations, in some cases probably maybe strong environmental regulations that they have, or economic regulations, because they're desperate for these handouts from the World Bank and from international capital?
Well, you know, it's really about the ranking. It has a huge implication. You know, as a country, it is not just about your environmental laws. It is basically, if you have regulations around real consultation with the communities whose lands that you might be planning to set up on a big operation, and if the World Bank gives you a ranking saying, oh, they have stiff regulations, you need to at least show that you have consulted, not just in English, but in the language that the people speak and understand. All of those things might be seen as a hindrance to setting up business in your country. And given that these countries do need credit, that, you know, we all know investment is good, but without questioning what kind of investment and who does it benefit, this push has been for just allowing foreign investors to come in to remove duties, whether it is import duties, so they can bring in their chemical fertilizers or their big machines, or whether it is to do away with your profit taxes and allow investors to operate for anywhere from 10 to 30 years without paying profit taxes, or to allow 100% repatriation of your profits. All of those have been put forward on which you are scored. Never mind, the consequence of that is no benefit to the national economy, plus disastrous implications for the local communities.
Now, why do the doing business rankings have so much power? Who's looking at them? I mean, is there any other way for these countries to be able to reach and get foreign development to come in, if that's what they want, or to be able to get credit without having to be beholden to the World Bank's doing business rankings?
Well, I think we cannot forget the international geopolitics of today's world that we live in. Given institutions such as the World Bank are under the control of the big rich donor countries, United States, Western nations, you find that these countries really have their backs against the wall. And it is this unequal structure which has continued to colonize and deny communities and people in third world countries to be able to really exercise their rights. So on one hand, yes, these rankings have become important because as an investor, people look at these rankings and they set what countries considered good for doing business with. Now, let me just tell you again that as an investor, you might not notice that Georgia, according to the World Bank, might be one of the best countries to do business with, or Sri Lanka, where the Human Rights Council of the United Nations has just charged that the government should be investigated for war crimes. They get much better rankings than, say, a country like Bhutan, where the government is focused on measuring happiness of its people. So what is good for business, never mind if it's bad for communities, is seen by the World Bank as a way to promote investments. The other thing I would say, which reflects this whole schizophrenic nature of the World Bank, they put out a report last year, which is mentioned in our report, Willful Blindness, which, by the way, to the listeners, all of the materials related to the campaign are available at a website called ourlandourbusiness.org, or visit us at oaklandinstitute.org. So in a report, World Bank last year said that smallholder farming has the proven track record for equitable development. However, to promote large-scale investments, large amounts of land have to be made available. So it is completely upside-down, backwards development model, which recognizes that if you want equitable development, we need to promote smallholder farming. We have enough evidence of that. However, while we know what works and what is successful, we are going to throw it out and promote large-scale investments, despite the consequences that we can see are coming in from all over the world.
Well, if you're just tuning in this morning, my guest is Amarada Mutal, and we're talking about a report that her organization, the Oakland Institute, just released called Willful Blindness, How the World Bank's Doing Business Rankings Impoverish Smallholder Farmers, and talking about the nefarious side of the World Bank in contrast to the humanitarian side that is, whose mission is to eliminate poverty around the world. And we're looking at the contradictions today between the two faces of the World Bank. What I find interesting, and as reading your report, I kept thinking about this thing that's going on in Oregon right now around genetically modified crops. I had a guest on a few weeks ago who's the campaign director for a ballot measure campaign that would basically ban GMO crops in Jackson County in southern Oregon. And what was interesting to me is that the biggest donor to defeat their ballot measure is Syngenta, the Swiss pharmaceutical company that is doing all these test plots of genetically modified sugar beets in Jackson County. And so here's a case of a corporation. It's not even an individual. It's a multinational corporation. They have no financial interests at all in serving the economy of the United States, let alone Jackson County. But they are putting in, I think they've raised $500,000 to defeat this ballot measure. And they're doing it in collusion with some of the other biotech companies that are also trying to foist GMO crops on us. So I thought, this is interesting. This is happening now in the United States, where we have large biotech and pharmaceutical companies that are trying to basically buy politics. It's probably more overt what's happening in Africa and Southeast Asia. But I think that I want to talk a bit about that connection, about how these companies are kind of beyond national governments, and what maybe are there connections in your mind between what's happening with what the World Bank sets up in Africa and in Asia, and I'm assuming also in South America, and what's going on right now in Jackson County, Oregon?
You know, I think that's a really important point. We often tend to think what's happening in Africa, Asia, other developing countries, it's so far away, and our reality is different. But really, what the point of the campaign, Our Land, Our Business, is that the corporations, thanks to the power and support from institutions such as the World Bank, have really launched an assault on our democracy, have launched an assault, an attack on our basic freedoms. So whether it is a food system, you know, the choice of the people in Oregon to be able to decide in Jackson County if they want to have their food labeled so they can make a choice not to be eating genetically engineered foods, or whether it is communities in places such as Sierra Leone or Senegal or South Sudan, where they say we want to be able to have access to our own fields so we can grow food for our families and our communities, have access to markets which are not destroyed by free trade agreements. The common thing in all of this is that these institutions come forward using the language of reducing hunger, reducing poverty. In California, when the corporations from Syngenta to Unilever to others came together to defeat our labeling proposition, it was a language of, but we do genetic engineering to feed the poor. If you actually label your foods, food will become more expensive. Total lies and myths. So it is really the same thing that the World Bank claims, that their goal is to end poverty, their goal is to promote food security, and to do that, investment is necessary, foreign investment is necessary. And while they promote these myths, they have no evidence to back it, that how will displacing smallholder farmers, creating a big, large-scale plantation to grow cotton or sugarcane or palm oil or some agrofuels, or even if growing food but for export, how will it improve food security of people? They cannot respond to our question that how will destroying livelihoods of smallholder farmers and turning them into plantation workers who have access to only menial, seasonal jobs, how will it ensure their food security every day, 12 months of the year? They're unable to promote evidence, but with their lies, they keep hoodwinking the public. And lastly, let me also mention, when it comes to doing business rankings, there was an internal review done inside the bank, which clearly showed that doing business rankings are not helping promote investment or development, and they're creating a race to the bottom. And the review suggested that these doing business rankings should be ended. But thanks to the Gates Foundation, and we know Gates Foundation is a big promoter of biotechnology, genetic engineering of crops, as well as the G8 countries, not only doing business rankings were maintained for 2014, but also now they have started a new thing called the benchmarking the business of agriculture, where there would be rankings specifically in the field of agriculture. So God forbid, as Senegal, you say, we are going to require labeling of GE foods. We will not let any foreign investors in who desire to grow GMO crops or they plan to use Roundup. If you do any of that, guess what would happen to you? You would get a terrible ranking, basically telling the world that you are a student who has scored very badly because you refuse to follow the dictates of the corporations, and therefore we're going to boycott you. We will not invest in you.
Well, actually, I just want to clarify one thing. The ballot measure in Jackson County is actually not about GMO labeling. We're going to have that ballot measure on the Oregon ballot in November, but the one that's being voted on in a couple of weeks in Jackson County is actually about banning the growing of GMO crops. And it's very similar to ordinances that are already in place in California, in Santa Cruz.
Exactly, in Mendocino and other places.
Right.
Well, I salute all the activists and all the people of Jackson County who have worked on this. And of course, despite the power of the corporations, we know that when people get organized, victory is ours. So success to everyone in Jackson County.
Well, I want to get back to the Gates Foundation. I heard Vandana Shiva speak a couple years ago about it was sort of the evil triangle, or I don't remember, but the organizations people would be most concerned about. And of course, Monsanto was way up there, but the Gates Foundation was right up there with Monsanto. So let's talk a little bit about what the Gates Foundation is doing in the area of global farming and their connections to really pushing for genetically engineered crops.
You know, a few years ago, we had put out a report called Voices from Africa. I mean, in the name of, again, improving food security, providing better seeds to farmers in Africa, Gates Foundation has played a big role in promoting technological solutions to problems such as hunger in third world countries, especially in Africa. The whole discourse has been that in the first Green Revolution, unfortunately, Africa was left out. So this time round, Africa is their focus for promoting a new Green Revolution, despite, again, the evidence, whether it is the ISTAD report, whether it is the UNCTAD report last year, there's enough evidence, including from Food and Agriculture Organization, that the best way to deal with hunger, the best way to deal with poverty in places such as the African continent is really to support smallholder farmers, is really to provide them extension services, credit facilities, protect their markets. But what we face today is this juggernaut of free trade agreements coming in with technological solutions where only what is large and big farms and supported by the big corporations can succeed. So it's really the desire is to create the Midwest that we have in this country, make it possible and implement it all over the world, denying the reality of billions of people who are smallholder farmers.
Well, what is the self-interest or whatever interest that the Gates Foundation has in promoting this agenda? Because the Gates Foundation supposedly, you know, came on board to end poverty in the world and to do all these great things. But it seems like their biggest mission that I've been seeing is promoting genetically modified crops and other technological fixes that overlook, that are very global in perspective and really undermining of local sovereignty.
You know, this would be a question best asked of the Gates Foundation as to why they continue to promote a model which is not wanted. Why is it being shoved down the throats of countries and communities and farming? And while you are at it, and if you get a chance to ask them of that model, I would also ask them that if they're planning to hire billions of smallholder farmers who would be losing their jobs, if their job openings at the Gates Foundation. Their whole vision of a successful farmer is one who is connected to the market. The problem is when we see problems of the world such as hunger and poverty as mere technological problems, we come up with technological solutions. And they do not seem to understand that it is a politics. I mean, right here in this country, when you have 500,000 families with children defined as being food insecure or going to bed hungry, when you have those kind of numbers, it doesn't have to do with a shortage of food production. It is a politics of the shameful minimum wage that we have. It is the shameful wage that the fast food workers, for instance, are being forced to work at, which does not take care of families. It is the absence of land and resources and water in third world countries that causes hunger. So when you take away the politics of it, you can promote technological solutions. And of course, in the process, you benefit corporations such as Monsanto. When we talk about genetically modified crops, let's not forget, there are crops that are really commercial and out there, are crops such as cotton and corn and canola, things that don't feed people. But the whole promotion of it has been through dealing with climate change, dealing with hunger, whereas, you know, it's a case of emperor has no new clothes. We have heard this before, and yet once again we are being told to believe them.
Actually, I'm thinking about a farmer I know in the Willamette Valley here who was talking about how the Willamette Valley has been off the radar screen of Big Ag until recently. But his theory is that they're destroying all the soil in the Midwest with growing largely genetically modified crops. And so they're looking for new areas. So whether it's Africa or Southeast Asia or the Willamette Valley, and again, it sort of ties us here in Oregon and also in some parts of California that have been holdouts from big scale commercial agriculture, that it's like they're going after the last vestiges. And I wonder if that's something that you see in the larger picture.
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's also our increasing appetite. At the Oakland Institute, we have looked at hundreds and hundreds of land deals all over Africa. We have looked at all kind of land deals in Papua New Guinea, in Latin America. And it's very interesting. It is our unending desire and appetite, whether it is the biofuel mandates of Europe and United States. You find investors from these countries going and securing land rights, water rights on huge acreage for which you get 99-year leases where you pay anywhere from 40 cents per hectare to, $6-$7 per hectare, the kind of land for which you would pay $14,000-$18,000 per hectare in this country, and you're using it to grow genetically modified corn for ethanol or you're trying to grow some other agrofuel crops. So it is definitely our increasing appetite. So while we talk about dealing with food security in these nations, most of the deals that we have looked at, either nothing has been done to the land, it is just lying idle, because the investors, so-called investors, are hoping to speculate on the land and sell it and make huge profits. Or you find the land being used to grow agrofuels. Or you find, even if being used to grow crops, those crops are for export markets, not for the local markets.
Now, before this land was leased, what was happening with this land? Were small farmers farming it?
You know, another excellent question. I mean, I could go on and share stories. I mean, let me just say in Ethiopia, where the government has embarked on a grand land lease program to become a renaissance state, 7 million hectares are planned to be given away to investors. When we have done research, we have found these lands were used by predominantly agro-pastoralists, by indigenous communities. So whether it is Anuaks in Gambela who have used those lands to grow their crops, and by the way, in a country which usually is in the news about hunger and famine, this is like the breadbasket of Ethiopia, and the local people are being forcibly removed from their lands. Same thing in Lower Omo, where agro-pastoralists have practiced agriculture, you know, flood retreat agriculture. They're being forcibly displaced. So 1.5 million people are being forcibly displaced from their lands to create these large-scale plantations for growing cotton and sugarcane. In case of Tanzania, the largest land deal, which involved 800,000 acres in three different spots, just in one spot, over 160,000 smallholder farmers would have been displaced. They were told that they would have to relocate, and if they wanted any assistance, which was $200, they would have to break down their own homes and move away. So this whole idea that there is unused, unproductive land in Africa, that these investors will go and develop so people can prosper, that's a lie. In Papua New Guinea, same thing, where 98% of the land is customary land, belongs to people. They might be poor, but they're growing 30 to 40 different kinds of vegetables and fruits. They are not nutritionally poor, and they're becoming nutritionally poor when you take away their access to the land and you convert it into a palm oil plantation.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Anuradha Mittal, who is the executive director of the Oakland Institute, and they just released a report called How the World Bank's Doing Business Rankings Impoverish Smallholder Farmers. We're looking at the impact that the World Bank is having on taking farmland away, basically, from small farmers in the developing world, and putting it in the hands of large mega industrial agribusiness corporations who are growing mostly non-food or crops for the global market. In the remaining minutes that we have left, Anuradha, I'd like to talk about what the project that you've been working on, what you're doing to change the dynamics of this and be able to restore the land to the people who deserve and who really rightfully should be farming this land.
You know, at the Oakland Institute, as a policy think tank, we have realized that research and information is key to be able to shatter through the myths of the World Bank and their lies, and we've done that so far very successfully. So on one hand, while exposing, for instance, the largest land deal in South Sudan or the largest land deal in Tanzania and putting forward the contract, which showed the lies of the investors, and it was not our word against theirs, but it was really their word against their own documents, that has really helped because people have been able to mobilize and people have been able to stay on their lands. But we also realize that we can't keep doing one investor after the other. And that is why this campaign, Our Land, Our Business, which targets those who are setting the policy environment, which really targets those who are the facilitators of these land grabs, such as the World Bank, through promoting making land a marketable commodity, we are really going after them because we need to really challenge institutions based in Washington, D.C. as a U.S.-based think tank. Our colleagues, our partners, impacted communities on the ground very courageously are standing up to so-called investors in their own countries as they try to destroy their fields, their homes. But what we can do in solidarity with them is not just challenge those investors, but really challenge these institutions of power, which are really in the belly of the beast.
I'm just having this image as we're talking. I'm thinking about how people, farmers all around the world in developing countries and actually here to some degree here in the United States, have been forced off their land in the last 50 years. And I have this image in my mind of when I arrived in Siem Reap, Cambodia about 10 years ago, and we were driving from the airport and I saw all these farmers who I think were coming home from work on their bicycles and we were basically walking their bicycles, carrying all their equipment. And it was this image. It was such a classic image of the farmers in Southeast Asia. But I started finding out while I was there that those farmers were about to be displaced by a whole miles and miles of high luxury hotels that were being built to attract mm-hmm. tourist industry. And it's a kind of a different side of the story than what you're talking about. But it seems to be examples of how if we do not support the small farmers around the world, that if they're not displaced by palm oil plantations, they're going to be displaced by so-called hotels. And what do we do to shift the power so that there's ways for the small farmers, particularly in developing countries, do not have to become refugees, basically, and do not have to like move to cities or basically give up or work for larger corporations?
You know, in the course of our work, we have been very privileged to march together, to stand side by side with the people, for instance, you are describing. What we can do is, on one hand, support their struggles. But at the same time, I mean, I can't tell you whether it is from Ethiopia to Senegal to Sri Lanka. Our partners have always said, we will not give up this fight. We will die for this land. And what we can do, rather than just write off their struggles and believe that the only development is when every country, every culture looks the same as it does here, we can support and join their struggles. One good way is on Our Land, Our Business. If you are an individual, please sign a petition. Headed towards the annual meetings of the World Bank, we want to generate millions of signatures from around the world, which are telling the World Bank to stop its rankings of doing business and to stop the benchmarking the business of agriculture. You can also get more involved. Visit our website at oaklandinstitute.org. There are many, many resources there. Get informed, get educated, because what we have realized is that while we're talking about problems in from Cambodia to Laos to Sri Lanka, wherever, very often, the people perpetuating injustice are from here. For instance, the largest investment deal in Tanzania involved an investor from Iowa. When the students of Iowa State University mobilized, when the citizens groups, such as Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement, mobilized, and work together with the communities on the ground in Tanzania. That land deal was halted in its tracks. So we have a lot of power. And this cross-border, organizing and international organizing, where we can shine the international light on the plight of the local struggle, it really helps bring a lot of support to the local communities. So I urge all the listeners, while you're at it, please visit ourlandourbusiness.org. Sign the petition today, right now.
And we'll have a link on our website to Our Land, Our Business, so people can just go directly there, as well as a link to the Oakland Institute, and you can get a handle. You can actually download the report that's called Willful Blindness, How the World Bank's Country Rankings Impoverish Smallholder Farmers. Well, in the last few moments, I'd like to talk about what can we do about the World Bank and the Gates Foundation? How do we make them accountable?
Well, you know, as I've been saying throughout this show, one big way to make World Bank accountable is to let it know that it cannot continue to come up with these policy prescriptions which would go unnoticed or unchallenged around the world. I think this is really about the Dracula effect. You know, once you have dragged the truth into the sunlight, it has no place to hide or to run. Because these institutions bank on the ignorance of most of us. They bank on the fact that we will not care. But when we get our voices heard, that we have our facts, we have our research, and we are not going back to business as usual, these institutions have to step down. I mean, let's not forget, ending structural adjustment programs did not happen overnight. It was his international collaborations, exposés as to what the banks was doing instead of ending poverty. It was really in the business of ending the poor. That kind of work is needed again. And we at the Institute look forward to joining up with everyone who's listening to today's program.
Well, a few months ago, I did another show on the World Bank, and that one was about how the World Bank basically encourages corruption. And it was more of an unintended consequence because of the way that the World Bank is structured and what it was encouraging. And it talks a little bit about the end of the structural adjustment. This book that I was interviewing the author of spoke about the end of the structural adjustment program and kind of all the controversies that that raised. But it also made me even more cynical about the World Bank, because it seems that the World Bank is often on the verge of becoming something good, is often on the verge of becoming what its mission statement says when you walk into the building in Washington, D.C. And then it doesn't change. So I'm wondering, besides putting pressure, petitions, exposing again and again the semi-nefarious side of the World Bank, what else can we do? I mean, it almost seems like this is an institution that really needs to be dismantled, because it seems like it doesn't know how to fix itself.
Well, I mean, you know, more than 20 years ago, international civil society had clearly denounced the World Bank and said 50 years is enough. At the Oakland Institute, we do not believe in working with the bank to fix their rankings or make them better. And that is why we are our overall arching, for instance, the goal of the campaign is to make it very clear. The bank has no legitimacy. It has no credibility after 70 years of financing projects which have been devastating to people around the world. You know, as you mentioned when we started our show, coal power plants, large dams, the displacement that it has caused, and of course impacted the most marginalized, you know, indigenous people, women, children, elderly. Given that track record, of course this institution has no legitimacy and should not be around. And that is why, I mean, we, of course, on one hand, can put a lock on this institution by ensuring that it has no say and it has no way of controlling how policies are generated in third world countries. So you can actually have true governance, where instead of the corrupt local economic elites who join up with elites of the Western institutions, instead of that, we could have genuine democracies, could have genuine governance, so the governments can actually ensure human rights of people, such as access to clean drinking water or schools or medicine, instead of those efforts being seen as you getting a bad score because of the World Bank.
I'm wondering if you would be willing, if I could get somebody for the Gates Foundation on, would you want to have a conversation sometime in the future on the show with them about where they're coming from and what you'd like to see them do?
We always welcome any kind of discussion if they're willing. In the past, I've had the opportunity to discuss these matters with Mr. Pingali. Some people would call it a debate, but I thought it was a good discussion. And if they are still willing to talk, we are always very glad to.
Well,
I'll be very happy to do so.
Great. I'll see if I can arrange that for some time during the summer, because I think it would be a really interesting conversation. And it's one thing for us to speculate about what makes them work, but I think to hear them at least try to explain themselves, it's a good opportunity for them, and it's a good opportunity for the listeners to hear that.
Definitely, I would very much encourage that, and I would be very happy to participate, because this is really about not just casting all kind of lies about them, but we could be honest about and share our opinion and base that conversation not on ideologies, but on facts and the research that's there. That's what we do at the Institute, and would love to hear their research, which might promote something else.
Okay, well, it's great. It's been really great talking with you, Anuradha, and I look forward to talking with you again.
I look forward to it too. Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks a lot. We've been talking this morning with Anuradha Mittal, Executive Director of the Oakland Institute, who just released a report called Willful Blindness, How the World Bank's Doing Business Rankings Impoverish Smallholder Farmers. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week we'll be in Pledge Drive, so it'll be hyper and exciting around here, and we hope that you'll tune in and become a member of KBOO if you're not, or renew your membership if you are. My guest is going to be Elizabeth Colbert, who's the author of very exciting and much talked about book called The Sixth Extinction. She's already been on the, she was actually on KBOO during our last Pledge Drive. We're going to have her back, and we'll be talking more about all the five extinctions before the one that we're facing right now. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Hamza al-Din and the Cronus Quartet. Thanks for listening.
And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Mobilizing Local Culture, a University of Oregon Arts Management Workshop in Portland, June 23rd through 28th, showcasing the ways in which local culture mobilized to make a difference in neighborhoods across the city. More info at aad.uoregon.edu/summerintensive.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Momenta, Monday, April 28th at the Clinton Street Theater. Momenta is a film and a movement to educate, raise awareness, and activate communities to stop all proposed coal exports in the Pacific Northwest. There will be a raffle after the film and a Q&A with people from the film. Again, that's Monday, April 28th at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Un toast aux exploités pour l'extermination des exploiteurs. Une épitaphe pour quelques copains.
The Union of Time Thieves is a monthly exploration of urban life. In this installment, we will be using one of the Situationist International's most beloved techniques to create a revised look at Portland's cityscape. Join us for one entire hour dedicated to détournement, fugitives, and refugees on the Union of Time Thieves on April 28th from 10 to 11 p.m. only on KBOO Portland.
And it is 11 a.m., 30 seconds past 11 a.m. You are tuned to KBOO in Portland. And coming right up, Grace Eagle Reed hosts Disability Awareness, a monthly show about issues affecting people with disabilities and their communities. And at 11:30, host Glenn Green interviews Doug Fine, author of Hemp Unbound. And thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support for community radio. To become a member or renew your support, just go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Redirect Guide, committed to promoting progressive regional businesses based upon the values of sustainability, localism, and social justice. Complete business directory and resource guide at redirectguide.com.